As the last in this series of talks, I shall discuss democracy after capitalism. The problem of Marxism and freedom nowadays comes down to the attitude of socialism toward democracy. This proceeds from a criticism of the status and prospects of democracy under the rule of the rich. Socialists recognize and acknowledge the immense benefits brought to progressive mankind through the democratic achievements of the bourgeois revolutionary movements and the democratic regimes issuing from them. These include religious freedom, that is, the separation of church from state, such political freedoms as the right to form parties and elect representatives by popular vote, freedom of the press and assembly, equality under the law, and other liberties included in the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen coming out of the French Revolution, and the most enlightened constitutions of other modern states. We defend all these valuable rights gained through the struggles of the people in the past and maintained by their efforts in the present. At the same time, socialists point out the limitations of the most democratic governments under the capitalist system. I dwelt on those last time and came to the conclusion that although the American people may enjoy some measure of political democracy, we have very little industrial or social democracy. Even more important, American capitalism, which in its progressive periods expanded democracy, is nowadays contracting its scope under the domination of the monopolists and militarists. For over 20 years, since the beginning of the Second World War, no laws have been passed in this country extending the freedoms of the people, but a host of laws, beginning with the Smith Act and culminating in the McCarran Act, have whittled them down. The only possible exception has been certain Supreme Court decisions and some lesser legislation affecting the civil rights of Negroes. But these have been counterbalanced by the anti-labor laws from Taft-Hartley to Kennedy, Landrum, Griffin. All this testifies that at its present stage, capitalism, despite its boasts about being the guardian of a free world, tends more and more toward the restriction and nullification of the democratic rights of the people. As capitalism becomes more and more hostile to democracy, and eventually incompatible with it, under fascism and some form of military dictatorship, the historical responsibility for defending, saving, and promoting democracy comes to rest upon the shoulders of another class, the industrial working class and its allies, especially through its revolutionary socialist movement. And throughout the world, in the past 50 years, we have seen the growing estrangement of democracy from capitalism, accompanied by a firm marriage of socialism with democracy. This affinity first becomes evident during a workers' struggle for power, and even for the very existence and maintenance of their organizations under the capitalist regime. The struggle for democracy reaches a new and higher historical level when the working people and their allies succeed in overthrowing the political structure of capitalist rule, casting off the bondage of imperialism, and taking over the economy of their country. This first happened in Russia in October 1917, since then in Yugoslavia, North Vietnam, China, and now Cuba and Algeria. It was necessary, after breaking up the old forms of the capitalist state through revolutionary mass action to set up a new form of political power on a new combination of class forces. And then the problem was immediately posed in practice, what kind of a state would that be? Before we talk about the practical experiences in this field, since the Russian Revolution of 1917, something should be said about the original teachings of Marx and Lenin on the subjects of democracy and workers' rule. The founders of scientific socialism, Marx and Engels, took it for granted that the abolition of capitalism would result in an immediate and immense expansion of democracy, since the new regime would be the outcome of the victory of the majority of the people over a minority of wealthy property owners. The essence of democracy is that the people have control over their livelihood, because without the right to work, that is, the right to live, all the other freedoms are subordinate. The right to a livelihood would be guaranteed by the publicly owned and operated economy and workers' control over that economy and the government. That's why the Communist Manifesto proclaimed the transformation of the proletariat into the ruling class would first of all mean the conquest of democracy. That is, of a real democracy for the majority of the people for the first time in the history of civilization. However, Marx, Engels, and their successors didn't leave the matter at that. They knew there would have to be a period of transition between the conquest of power by the working class and the building of a socialist society. The political regime during this epoch, the duration of which could not be foretold in advance, because it depended upon the rate of progress of the International Socialist Revolution. The political regime would take the form of the rulership of the working class, based upon the alliance of that class with other plebeian elements of the population, such as the shopkeepers, professionals, artisans, poor peasants, working farmers, and so on. The dictatorial features and functions of the new regime were to be directed exclusively against the class enemies of the revolution. That is, those who were openly trying to overthrow the worker state, erase the achievements of the revolution, and restore the old order, as they are trying to do today, both from within and from without, and more especially from without, in connection with the Cuban Revolution. The harsh military measures taken during this period were an inescapable necessity of the struggle to keep the means for abolishing class society, for building a new one, and defending the newly won democracy of the people. However, from the very beginning, this form of rule and its abridgments of democracy in connection with the struggle to protect the new organs of power and the new forms of property would signify far more democracy for the previously oppressed and exploited masses than they had ever known in the past. The classical work on this subject was written by Lenin on the eve of the October Revolution in an unfinished pamphlet entitled The State and Revolution. In it, Lenin explained that the workers need their state for two main purposes. One is destructive, that is, to curb, crush, hold back the resistance of the exploiters. The other is constructive, to guide the great mass of the population in the work of socialist economic construction. But Lenin didn't stop at this point. That was only his starting point. He discussed the measures that would be required to ensure that the state power of the new regime would be genuinely democratic, under the control of the working masses, responsible to them, and responsive to their demands. He clearly understood the dangers of a return to the militarized and bureaucratized machinery of the government under capitalism, and he wanted to see the new government forestall any such political retrogression. What are the principal institutions of the old order as we know it today? These are the standing army, that is, the brass hats, the police, the bureaucracy, the clergy, and the judiciary. Lenin proposed that these parasitic and repressive organs of the old state be done away with or replaced in the following ways. Replace the professional army with the people in arms, a popular militia such as you have in Cuba. Strip the police of all political functions and make them responsible to the organized workers and their councils. Make full-time functionaries at all levels real servants of the people and not overlords of the people by keeping them under the supervision and control of the workers' government. Remove all state support from the clergy. You would have complete freedom of belief, but if any group of believers wanted to maintain the clergy, that was their democratic right, but it would have to be done at their expense, and not that of the community as a whole. Finally, the old irremovable judges were to be replaced by elected judges or by people's courts staffed by the friends or neighbors of individuals indicted for any crime. The aim of these measures was to deprive all the powerful agencies of repression of any arbitrary powers and place them under the watchful eyes of the people until such time as the functions they perform in a professional way and in a full-time manner could be fulfilled by the masses of the people themselves in their leisure time. All this was to be assured by the following transitional measures. First, all officials were to be elected and subject to recall at any time for any ill performance of their obligations, just as shop stewards are today in places where the workers have control over their own union organization. Second, none of these servants of the workers' state would be paid more than the highest paid worker. And as a matter of fact, it would be looked upon as a good thing if they received less. Third, more and more of the functionaries would come out of the ranks of the working people themselves and return to their former occupations or their other occupations when their special assignments in the state apparatus were completed. Fourth, in the sphere of political representation, apart from the everyday work of the government, Lenin stated there would have to be a complete break with all the evils of capitalist parliamentarianism, or as we know it, the office holders' racket. These political institutions would be transformed from mere debating societies designed to dupe the people and carry out the dictates of the rich. They would be transformed into real working bodies. The representatives, said Lenin, must themselves work. That is, they shouldn't merely debate and pass laws. They would execute these laws, verify their results in actual practice, themselves be directly responsible to the electorate, so that they wouldn't be high and mighty individuals somewhere off in a state or a national capital, passing laws which didn't take into account the real conditions and needs of the people and the results of the application of the laws which they had passed. And they could at any time be summoned back to their districts and be made accountable to the voters for what they were doing or not doing. The kind of organization needed for carrying out measures of this sort had already been foreshadowed in the Paris Commune of 1871. They were first created in the Russian Revolution of 1905 and revived in the Revolution of 1917. These were the Workers, Peasants, and Soldiers Council. The Russian name for them is Soviets. These democratic organizations of the revolutionary masses were not originally created by the provision or directive of any political party. And as a matter of fact, for a short time, even the Bolshevik party resisted acceptance of them. The original Soviets were spontaneously improvised by the workers themselves in order to carry on their struggle against Tsarism and the capitalist rulers. These representative organizations, the councils, became the framework and foundation of the new state apparatus in the Soviet Union after the October 1917 triumph. It's important to note that in almost every great revolution of our era, which has really surged up from below, from the movements, the demands, and the aspirations of the people, they have almost from the beginning formed such democratic organs of power. This was the case in the German Revolution of 1918, in the Second Chinese Revolution of 1925-27, at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War in 1936, and most recently in the anti-bureaucratic socialist revolution of the Hungarian masses of 1956. The councils of Soviets are not simply organs for the exercise of the people's power. They're more than that. In order really to serve the people, they must also act as the arena where all the revolutionary tendencies in the working class can put forward and fight for the adoption of their views and proposals by delegates freely elected from the shops, farms, regiments, and offices. Internal democracy in the councils, in the Soviets, is the surest, in fact, the only guarantee for political democracy within a workers' state. Everyone familiar with the facts knows by now that this program of workers' democracy, projected by the founders of Marxism and put into practice by the Bolsheviks under Lenin and Trotsky after 1917, could not be sustained under the given historical circumstances. The democracy of the early Soviet Republic from 1917 to 1923 was subsequently strangled and replaced by the totalitarian autocracy of Stalinism, in which both Soviet democracy and party democracy were non-existent. And all the enemies of socialism, especially in our own country, use this historical defeat of the first experiment in working class political democracy in order to prove that workers' power must necessarily end in despotism. They contend that the Marxist forecast of a more splendid and bountiful democracy after the revolution is nothing but a myth, a dream, or as certain burned ex-radical intellectuals say, a lost illusion of their youth and of the youth of the Russian Revolution. And indeed, If you are a revolutionary, especially in the United States, it would be simply stupid, as so many people connected with the Communist Party have done, to wave aside the real facts and say we are not here confronted with a very important political problem that requires a scientific explanation and a forthright answer. Because you will never get anywhere with the American working people unless you can convince them that they're going to get more liberty after they get rid of capitalism than they have today. It's absolutely necessary for everyone interested in the advancement of socialism to understand and explain why and how it happened that the first practical experiment in workers' power failed to fulfill the expectations of its authors and gave rise to the bureaucratic one-man rule of Stalin and his successors. And here is where his successors have defaulted. In his famous speech at the 20th Congress of the Russian Communist Party of 1956, and again at the 22nd Congress in October 1961, Khrushchev condemned what happened under Stalin, but he gave not the slightest Marxist or scientific explanation of this one-man rule whatsoever, as even many of his notable followers have acknowledged, people like Gomulka in Poland and the late Togliatti in Italy. But there is an explanation for it. The main reason for this abhorrent political relapse in the Soviet regime was set forth by one of the two leaders who was most instrumental in its establishment in the first place. And that man was Leon Trotsky. In The Revolution Betrayed and Other Writings, which I recommend your reading in connection with this problem, because you cannot be a politically literate person in our modern world unless you understand what is set forth there. Trotsky explained how and why the first workers' state fell victim to the adverse domestic and international conditions which attended its early years. The development might be made easier for you through the following analogy. The growth and the features of any child are determined not simply by the organism he is born with, the way in which he comes out of the maternal womb, but even more by the kind of conditions he grows up under and the kind of nutriment he has or is deprived of. The same thing is true of an infant revolution and the new regime which issues out of that revolution. What were the main circumstances and forces which contributed to and finally resulted in the destruction of Soviet democracy? On the international scene, it was the failure of the revolution to be extended into the highly industrialized countries of Western Europe. This kept the Soviet Union for decades isolated, surrounded by a ring of hostile imperialist powers. Moreover, it was cut off from the resources and labor of the advanced countries and the world market. At home, democracy was depressed by the weariness of the Russian masses who had gone through first a world war, 1914, 1917, two revolutions in 1917, 4 years of civil war, fighting against intervention on 21 fronts, hunger, famine, all kinds of deprivations. And this tired out the bulk of the Russian people. On top of that, some of the new possessors of power in the state grew more and more conservative. They wanted to lean back and rest for a while. Take it easy. Enjoy the fruits of their struggles. They were under heavy pressure from the peasantry, which didn't have the international outlook of the revolutionary socialist-minded workers. But above all, and here we come to the groundwork of the process, democracy was endangered and ultimately overthrown by the effects of the terrible poverty, the low productive and cultural level of the country. Now, I explained in reviewing the history of democracy under capitalism that, as a rule, democracy has largely been a privilege of wealthy nations, and that poor ones, even if they evolve or set up democratic institutions, find that they do not have very stable foundations. We see that in Asia, in Africa, and in Latin America. Something of the same later applied to the worker states we have known today. The poorer and more backward they are, the less productive are their economies, the more powerful are the tendencies toward bureaucratism, and the more liable are the anti-democratic forces and elements to become predominant and crush the political institutions and rights of the workers and peasants. To have and to maintain democracy, it's indispensable, but it's still not enough to nationalize and plan the economy. It's necessary to so develop the powers of production that there's enough of the necessities of life for everyone. Otherwise, the old rat race for food, clothing, and shelter, which has gone on in class society, becomes duplicated. The exercise and expansion of democracy depends upon a certain level and standard of living. Unless people have time for political life, for discussion of political problems, for direct participation in the public affairs of their country, the tasks of administration have to be handed over, vested, and concentrated in a narrow group of professional functionaries, specialists in the administration of the economy, of the army, of the affairs of state, of art, of science, of technology, and so on. It has been the great, though unavoidable, misfortune of the world socialist movement that the first worker states had to be established not in industrially advanced countries, but in the most backward countries of Europe, Asia, and now Latin America. These states could not provide their citizens with enough consumers' goods to take care of their basic needs, or, as was the case in Cuba, they become embargoed and partially throttled by their imperialist antagonists. Therefore, inequalities of all kinds were engendered, which produced friction between different layers of the population. With these inequalities came the growth of social antagonisms. No one likes to see some other person or group of persons have enough or more of the necessities or amenities of life when they are deprived of them, especially in a revolutionary society. When the demands for consumers' goods by different sections of the population cannot be adequately satisfied, or rather, in order to satisfy the demands of one, you must take away or withhold the necessities or comforts of life from the other, some power has to step in and regulate the situation. Some power has to decide who is to get what and how much. After Soviet and party democracy has been crushed, this power became the Soviet bureaucracy, the political representatives of the more privileged layer of the worker state, who had usurped power in the Bolshevik Party and in the Soviet Republic. The Stalinist faction took advantage of the conflicts within the country, playing one sector of the population against another, elevating themselves above the working people that they claimed to speak for, and became totally independent of them. The low productivity of the Soviet economy, the inescapable high capital investments, which took more away from the supply of consumer goods, the tremendous military expenditures imposed upon the country, which have endured to this day, and which every worker state has been paying heavily for, the enormous wastefulness of an uncontrolled administrative apparatus meant a continuous lack of the most important objects of personal consumption. There was simply not enough food, clothing, and shelter to go around. It is in these economic sources that we must find the fundamental reasons for the omnipotence, the rise of the Stalinist bureaucracy. But, you may say, since then the Soviet Union has scored great economic successes. This is certainly so, and they are continuing. But although these have been adequate to take care of the needs and comforts of the upper crust of Soviet society, and even over the past 10 years to steadily better the meager living standards of the bulk of the people, they're still too modest to meet the growing requirements and raise up the material and cultural standards of the people to the level of the wealthier capitalist countries, because the demands and desires of people in industrialized countries increase, and the average standard of living must include more and more goods. At the time of the Russian Revolution, a radio or a TV set was not considered necessary. But it is today. What?
A little early for TV.
Yeah, that's true. But it is now, in all countries, considered part of the average standard of living. The bureaucracy takes good care to see that the interests of the privileged, the strongest sectors of their society, are satisfied first and most of all, and only give grudging concessions to the producing masses. In order to maintain their rule, they must keep the masses of the workers and peasants deprived of direct exercise of their political rights, which would enable them to institute a radically different division of the national income and to level the inequalities which still prevail in the Soviet Union and the other worker states. Here we come to a key question, which is inevitably raised against the revolutionary socialists. Is a bureaucratized state power inevitable after a victorious worker-peasant revolution? I'm sure all of you, at one time or another, have heard or at least read this argument, which is part of the stock in trade of all the anti-Marxists. Our reply is this: the establishment of a non-democratic regime is not at all inevitable. Certain tendencies of bureaucratism would necessarily manifest themselves in the transitional period from capitalism to socialism. This is no longer an hypothesis, it's an historical fact. It has already been proved by the fate and the misfortunes of the worker states, as it was previously demonstrated by the condition of the workers' movements in the capitalist countries. But the point is this: these bureaucratic tendencies need not become all-powerful. They need not stamp out democracy. They need not become organized into a political system, as they have been under the Stalinized regimes. The revolutionary workers and their leadership can consciously take measures to combat, counteract, and hold them in check until there no longer exists the economic, social, and cultural conditions in the country and in the world that make any kind of bureaucratic practices possible. It is one of the signal achievements of the Cuban government that it recognized this danger when it reared itself in their country after the taking of power. You are familiar, perhaps, with the phenomenon known as Escalantism in Cuba, when some of the older representatives of the Cuban Communist Party attempted to use favoritism and privilege in setting up a new party. Fidel Castro and his close associates noted that, exposed it, and have been doing their best to eradicate it thoroughly. Having made this generalization, it's necessary to explain just how the worker struggle against bureaucratism should proceed. And I'd like to sketch these along the following lines. First, what has to be done within the political field? There must be a thoroughgoing democratization of the government machinery. All the power is to be exercised by the workers' councils, freely elected by all those who work in whatever capacity, whether in the city or in the country. This means that all parties which accept the revolutionary regime and work loyally within it are entitled to function and to compete for the support of the workers for their program and for their proposals. And I come now to an important point. Nowadays, the Stalinists and many of the sympathizers and followers of Khrushchev, what we might call the neo-Stalinists, maintain that communism, socialism, Marxism means one state, one party. This inviolable principle of the single party regime is characteristic of Stalinist totalitarianism. It does not belong to the program of Marxism, of Bolshevism, or of Trotskyism, which carries them forward. You will not find a word about it in the writings of any Marxist up to the time of Stalin. The Bolsheviks, for example, formed their first revolutionary government in 1917 together with another party, the Left Social Revolutionaries. The Bolshevik leaders tried in every way to keep the other parties as part of the Soviet regime. They failed in their efforts from 1917 to 1921, not because they didn't wish to have a multi-party regime, but because the social revolutionaries and Mensheviks went over to actively engage in counter-revolution during that Civil War period. But the conception of Soviet democracy requires multi-party competition for the votes, for the support of the working masses. This is even necessary for the Vanguard Party, which rules the state, to make sure that it doesn't deviate too far from the demands and the welfare of the workers. The existence of other parties competing with it acts as a continual prod to the ruling party and even prepares the prospect of a peaceful replacement if the ruling party does not fulfill its functions. Second, there must be freedom of the press and assembly, as guaranteed by the present Bill of Rights in the American Constitution. Certainly a worker state can do no less, and it certainly ought to do a great deal more. That means that every party, every tendency, according to their support in the country, will have proportionate time to speak their piece over TV and radio, to congregate in meeting halls, to have print shops, to have headquarters, and all the necessary material paraphernalia for soliciting support of the people and carrying on their political life. Third, all state functionaries at all levels should be elected. No irremovable permanent appointees. Fourth, no official shall be paid more than a skilled worker. That's certainly true in our own party. And I must say that all of our functionaries are paid much less than the skilled workers who belong to our organization, and even some of the unskilled. Fifth, judges shall be elected, and all legal officials will be under the control of the people's courts and the workers' councils. All the necessary judicial safeguards will be guaranteed to arrested persons, whether it's a writ of habeas corpus, which prevents you from being locked in jail indefinitely, or the right to have counsel, the right to know precisely what you're charged with, the right to be tried immediately, the right not to be punished too severely, and all those legal rights which enlightened nations have today. Sixth, if there has to be a secret police for work against the counter-revolutionaries, it should never be used against the ordinary citizen. Finally, the workers and peasants shall be the armed forces in the state. Now, these measures can protect and promote democracy within the nation and the workers' government. But in addition to these, it's necessary to see that democracy is safeguarded and maintained in the ruling party, the vanguard party of the working class, which presumably has won the confidence of the workers during the struggle for power and during the period of the reconstruction of the old society and the building of the new one. For this purpose, it's essential to keep clear the dividing line between the government and the party. The two may be interconnected, of course, but they are not to be made identical. The government shall have no right to intervene in the internal life, the discussions or decisions of the party, or to take police actions against any of its members or their opinions, as is customary under the Stalinized regime. Under Stalin, if any member of the party dared voice an opinion contrary to the official line, the secret police would nab him, put him in jail, or in a work camp. The party itself shall be thoroughly democratic, the leaders periodically elected, conventions regularly held, not as, for example, in the Soviet Union, no party conventions for 10 or 12 years, or for that matter in China, you haven't had a party convention contrary to the constitution of the Chinese Communist Party since 1958. There shall be freedom to form tendencies and no penalty for unorthodox ideas, no reprisals for criticism of leaders or of official policies. No idolatry of leaders who are supposedly infallible. So much for the government and the ruling party and the guarantees for their democratic functioning. Now, what about the trade unions? These are not to be merely an instrument of state policy in industry or for raising productivity. The unions themselves must have a certain independence in respect to the government, so they can, if need be, protect the income and welfare of their members against any injustices or arbitrary actions of officials. Because officials, for administrative efficiency, very often try to cut corners, as you know from your own experience, and disregard the wishes and welfare of the rank and file. Workers should have the right to strike with no penalties attached if they're driven to exercise it. And it's easy to see why. Workers don't lightly go on strike. and especially under a workers' peasants' republic. And if they should do so, it's a warning signal for the government, which rests upon this class, that there is something wrong here that has to be corrected. Factories and industries shall be administered by councils of workers' representatives, elected by everyone in the departments, plants, and industries. The National Council of Workers shall draw up, adopt, administer, and revise the overall economic plan, whether for a year, 3 years, or five. Now, I have very hastily and sketchily itemized only a few of the key measures of democratization. But what is their central aim? It is to expand workers' democracy by drawing in the maximum number of workers to political life, making them genuinely active citizens of their states in all its functions. But in the Soviet Union and similar regimes, there has been another issue agitating its citizens. And that has to do with the cultural, artistic, and scientific life of the country. There should be no uniformity or regimentation over these activities. One of the essentials of democracy is cultural and educational freedom for intellectual, artistic, and scientific pursuits so that they can progress without impediment. So much for the measures to be taken within a workers' regime in a given nation to make it as democratic as possible. But historical experience has shown that all of these measures will not be adequate to save and strengthen democracy unless two other more basic conditions are realized. One is the development of the national productive forces, so that there is enough goods and services for everyone, so there is no penury, misery, and inequality, no people who have at the expense of others who have not. The second precondition is the extension of the socialist revolution to other, and especially the more advanced countries. These two conditions, the rapid and balanced growth of the nationalized economy and of its social wealth, and the drawing of the advanced workers into the world revolution, go hand in hand. But they do not have equal importance. The second condition is more important than the first in the upholding of democracy and the advancement of socialism. Why? Because you cannot build socialism in a single country. As a form of life and labor, socialism must be in all vital respects superior to capitalism. Socialism can only be built on an international basis, with the collaboration of the workers in all countries, with the participation of the people in the highly industrialized centers, who will lend aid to the majority of mankind who live in more backward conditions. The extension of socialist power to the West will give the greatest impetus to the struggle for democratization in the existing worker states by strengthening and encouraging the people there to curb and eliminate the bureaucratic overlords who have strangled the democracy which was promised by the original Bolshevik Revolution. Another important aspect of democracy has to do with the problem of nationalities. This has become especially sensitive in connection with the relations between the big and the small, the more and the less developed of the workers' states. Yugoslavia, Hungary, China, and now Romania have complained of their treatment as inferiors and unequals by the rulers of the Soviet state. The problem has two sides. One concerns the relations between independent workers' states. The maxim of socialism is not only that the relations between states must be based upon equality and fraternity and respect for the rights and integrity of each nation. Even capitalist states profess to conform to that rule in international relations, however much they disregard it in reality. A powerful workers' state must lean over backwards in all its dealings with small nations to give complete assurance that it is not misusing its superiority to the detriment of the weaker peoples. The same rule must apply to any national minorities which inhabit a socialist regime. These are entitled to special consideration in view of the oppression they may have suffered from the governing power in the past and their apprehension that this mistreatment may continue in newer forms under new conditions. One of the major crimes in a worker state will be discrimination against any person or group because of their national origin, race, or color. This will be met with severe penalties, especially if it comes from official sources or from government job holders, and will be forestalled and quarantined by education and example from the earliest age. And now I come, after five talks, to the conclusion, the main lesson of this review of 2,500 years of the development of democracy in the world. And that is the question inevitably directed against Marxists and socialists in this country. It is this: what are the prospects of democracy in the event of a socialist revolution in the United States? One of the first questions any thinking person, no matter what his or her status in our society, will ask you when you're trying to propagandize or proselytize for a socialist America is this: will we be confronted with the same dangers of Stalinization, of totalitarianism, after capitalism is abolished here, has happened in the Soviet Union? What are we to answer when this question is posed, as it almost invariably is? And don't think you can duck it, especially if you get up in any assembly of inquiring individuals. I've briefly explained what the specific historical reasons were for the undermining and destruction of democracy after the heroic years of the revolution in the USSR. The point I want to emphasize is this: not one of the basic conditions that gave birth to Stalinist despotism are or will be present when the working people, black and white, take over in this country. And to demonstrate this, I want to itemize the main features for you. First, instead of a country existing on a low level of economy, a low level of culture, the American workers already have and will certainly preserve and promote the highest economy and culture in the world. Today, the average American has greater technological skill than any other. The second point: we do not have in this country an immense number of peasants living in archaic and pre-capitalist conditions. We don't even have any agricultural problem, as they have in China and the Soviet Union today. Within the capitalist system, we suffer not from underproduction, but from a problem of overproduction in agriculture. Less than one-tenth of our people are involved in agricultural pursuits, and this number is being reduced rapidly with every passing year. One of the major achievements of American capitalism has been that it has already solved this economic problem for socialism, a problem that the more backward worker states are still grappling with. And among other things, we can thank capitalism for that. The third point is this. There will be no isolation of the revolution and its regime within a circle of hostile nations, as happened with the Soviet Union, now with China and with Cuba. On the contrary, there will already have been in existence worker states elsewhere that can be fraternized with and not fought against. In this Western Hemisphere, other countries will quickly follow the example of the United States if they have not already preceded it in the march toward socialism and away from capitalism. The fourth point, the lessons of the dearly bought experience of the past should help us avoid the repetition of the errors committed by our predecessors in constructing socialism. This experience is incorporated in the program, in the tradition of the Socialist Workers' Party, and we intend to transmit it to others as I am trying to do today. That's one reason we think we shall be able to get the better of the Stalinists and anybody who follow in their footsteps. The fifth point, there is already in operation in the workers' states that already exist a powerful, irrepressible tendency toward democratization. We see that in the de-Stalinization processes going on in the Soviet bloc. We see it in the struggle of the new revolutionary party and regime in Cuba against Escalantism. We see it in Algeria, where there have been set up peasants' committees to operate agricultural enterprises. We see it in Yugoslavia, which has instituted the first experiments in the workers' control of industry. And all these aggregate lessons will be at our disposal, and we can improve on them and apply them even better. Still another point. Is it realistic to anticipate that when the Negro millions, when the American working class, together with them, has overthrown the mightiest capitalist power structure in the world, in which they would have to fight the monopolists, the militarists, the trade union bureaucrats, that after that, they're going to permit a new kind of bureaucrat to be imposed upon them in place of the old masters they've just gotten rid of? I don't think it's very likely. But even so, there is an even more fundamental assurance that this will not eventuate. There will be no economic or social necessity for such a relapse into bureaucratic despotism to take place. We are in the richest country of the world. The streams of wealth can flow so abundantly that everyone can very quickly have whatever they need and want in the way of basic necessities, comforts, and greater luxuries than they have ever known. The remaining inequalities will be minor and of an episodic kind and will constantly diminish as the new economy and new society exhibit their potential. For these reasons, we can look forward confidently to the flowering of democracy in a socialist America. All the basic conditions of the struggle in the climatic phase of the world revolution, which will take place in the United States will be the very opposite of what they were in the initial phases of the socialist revolution, which have taken place in Russia, Eastern Europe, China, Yugoslavia, or even Cuba. These opposite conditions will facilitate and guarantee a different